Welcome to WDRT's Thursday morning show, Conversations. My name is Dina Eccles, and in honor of Labor Day, I invited a guest who is deeply invested in workers' rights and worker justice. And while Labor Day was Monday, it seems we could be learning more about what is happening for workers today and every day. My guest by telephone is Frida Ballard. Frida is an organizer with Worker Justice Wisconsin. Her focus these days are worker-owned cooperatives, specifically for Latine immigrant workers. Currently, she is pursuing a PhD in linguistics from UW-Madison and developing a Latine-focused housing cooperative called Zapata. Okay, so that's a plate full of activity, Frida. Thanks for taking the time to be on the call today.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks for having me.
And I'd like to begin, as I always do, I'd like to begin with you. Have you always had a passion towards cooperatives and towards workers' justice?
Yeah, so my entrance into the co-op world was through housing co-ops when I was in undergrad. I went to undergrad at UT Austin, and there's a pretty lively co-op, housing co-op world there. That's where I lived during undergrad, and I became involved in the board and some of the governance and executive committees there. And I carried that with me when I eventually moved up to Madison. So that was my entrance into the co-op world.
I see. Okay. And what about the workers' end of it?
The worker end of it came later. It was mostly during the beginning of the pandemic. I was supposed to start, I was studying to do courtroom interpreting, but then with the pandemic, all the court dates got pushed back several years.
Oh,
and
right.
So I ended up doing medical interpreting instead. And so I did remote medical interpreting for a couple years. And by then I was already in Wisconsin, and a lot of my patients were dairy farmers in the Dodgeville area. And so that's when I was kind of really directly exposed to what the patients were saying, the accidents and the issues that they're experiencing in work. So that's how I got into kind of the workers' rights area that I'm now doing. And then eventually my worlds, those two worlds kind of merged at worker justice, thankfully.
Yeah, I see. That's very great how that worked together for you. So what kinds of things were you hearing that made you, you know, kind of swerve your direction?
Yeah, I had mostly workplace accidents, workers that would come in that had suffered some serious accidents. Some of them were kind of more a result of repetitive motion, but still would definitely fall under a workers' comp claim, but were told by their employers to not report it as a workplace accident and to instead either take the hit financially or that they would be promised that the employer would promise to pay their medical bills, which of course never ends up working out. But that was most of what I was seeing was workplace accidents and then also some wage stuff. But that often didn't come up in healthcare conversations.
Right, no, but you were seeing it. I know there was just recently a young child that was killed in a farming accident.
Right,
you know, somewhere where they, you know, really quite frankly shouldn't have been, but.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is really important because, and this is one of the reasons I wanted to have you on the call today is to bring to the forefront for a lot of people. They don't hear about these things, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Everything's kind of kept quiet and to the side. And it's just like our energy, you know, we just turn on the switch and it's there. And just mm-hmm. like for the farm workers, we just go to the refrigerator and the food is there. And we're not thinking about how it's getting there and what might be happening to people.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm glad you could do it. So let's talk cooperatives then, because that might be something also that people don't fully understand, you know?
Right. Yeah, so I think probably most people in Wisconsin anyway are likely the most familiar with consumer co-ops and producer co-ops. Ocean Spray, Land O'Lakes.
Organic Valley.
Yep, Organic Valley, right? Those producer co-ops. People probably know about those. or consumer co-ops, which are kind of more in the realm of either credit unions, which operate essentially as a co-op, and some of them are co-ops, or, you know, food co-ops like Willie Street in Madison, but there's also the Viroqua food co-op, right?
Mm-hmm, right.
I think people are familiar with those that you buy essentially like a membership, but the membership is an actual like financial stake in the company. The worker co-op is essentially the same thing of shared ownership, but it's the workers that share the ownership, not the consumer. So producer co-op, if they're growing things or raising animals. A worker co-op is similar, except you're providing a product or a service.
Mm-hmm.
So those, I think, are the most adjacent in their structures.
And are you seeing it increase?
In general?
Yeah.
I've only been here for 3 years, so maybe from where I stand anyway, the ones that exist here in Madison, at least from what I see, they're pretty consistent once they're established, and they're more resilient than some other types of businesses against financial recessions. But I don't see a whole lot of growth or a lot of new ones coming up.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, the biggest barrier is finding capital, and because they're often started by just regular people and no outside investment, it is harder to get them started, but once they're started, they're likely to continue for a really long time.
Mm-hmm.
So the startup is the biggest barrier. So I don't see anyway a whole lot starting. The funding is hard to come by, but it could be different in the agricultural world, which I unfortunately don't incubate producer co-ops. Or consumer co-ops, my side is the worker co-op side. The funding sources can be different for agricultural cooperatives, though.
I would think, you know, once you could get some land and
right.
get that started. So you recently took a trip to Puerto Rico, I understand.
Yes.
For a conference on cooperatives.
Yes, it's the ACE Institute. It's a cooperative educators conference. So it's people that are doing the job that I do, which is develop and incubate them. So the people that are part of an organization or some kind of institution that is doing this development work. So it's very specialized, very, very specialized.
I was going to say,
conference. It was really eye-opening because Wisconsin has a really long history of cooperativism. Especially worker co-ops. But, you know, other states see Wisconsin as like the mecca of this is what good legislation for co-ops looks like. But after reading their laws and looking at what their co-op structure is, I mean, that's the that's the end goal for me now, is achieving something like what Puerto Rico has. So I guess to recap of what I admire about their structure is so the co-op system in Puerto Rico began first with the financial co-ops. So they started as small mutual aid groups,
mm-hmm.
and then became formalized institutions as credit unions and as insurance companies. And because the credit unions and the insurance companies were the first cooperatives to really begin and take hold, they really laid a lot of this groundwork for then financing all the co-ops that came after. So then the producer co-ops and the consumer co-ops and the worker co-ops came. And those were the same people that pushed legislation to make these a recognized business entity. So it really all began kind of opposite to Wisconsin. It began with the financial ones first.
Hmm.
So there is, for a very long time, and even more so to this day, a very consistent source of funding. So a person or a group of people that are wanting to start a co-op, there is an institution that will educate them, fund them, and then help them with continued education and compliance years down the line.
Huh.
So it is very centralized.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of education that goes into it that is funded by the credit unions, but also partially by some buy-in by the co-op members into this league of cooperatives. And then also that is matched by the government of Puerto Rico.
That's great. So now are people benefiting? Are you seeing that it's really paying off?
It appears so, for sure. Some of the challenges for people on the island are very, I think, unique to them, but also very much not at all. Some of the main benefits that I saw were very tangible ones, like electrical co-ops that emerged after Hurricane Irma and Maria.
Right.
Because the government was not taking care of the rural folks. And so the co-ops emerged to fill in that gap.
Huh.
Or also a lot of for-profit banks like Santander completely pulled out of the island in 2019 after these protests against the government. And so then credit unions stepped in to fill in the gaps that those banks had left. So there is a lot of kind of direct problem solving by these co-ops. So there is a lot of public support for them and recognition of, you know, this co-op has literally kept lights on in my house or has kept cash flow in my town.
Mm.
And I heard a lot of that. And so from that standpoint, when you have a very tangible benefit, the kind of ideological benefit of cooperatives, of being a kind of form of resistance, then kind of comes naturally.
Right. It's just interesting to me because, I'm sure you're aware that the cooperatives, rural cooperatives, are how electricity came to be in the 1930s. Here,
mm-hmm.
You know, that utility companies didn't want to invest in, you know, the infrastructure that it would take to run rural cooperatives. So the people came together, and that's actually how it began. However, saying that, I've watched the cooperative that I participate in to get my electricity, I've watched it move more and more away from the original cooperative spirit and be moving more and more towards corporative. And it's interesting. I think you have to, the education component is very real. And that sense of ownership from everyone that, you know, because technically we are member owners, but a lot of people have given away their power of membership by not voting, not showing up, you know?
Right.
And part of that seems to have a lot to do with the kind of media that's put out by the quote-unquote cooperative, you know? Like, don't worry, we got your back. The lights are on and everything's cool, and we're going to put up another nuclear power plant. But you know,
right.
So interesting. So in at the conference, were there people from all over the world, or just the United States, or how did that go?
It was mostly the U.S., Canada, Mexico, Puerto Rico, some from Haiti as well.
Mm.
So it's kind of North America.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. It's good to know. And is there a way, if somebody were interested in pursuing something like that, is there a link or a website or something that people could check out?
Yeah, the ACE is acecoop.coop, I believe.
ACE, as in ACE?
Correct, yeah.
Okay, ACE Co-op. All right, well, there you go. So... thank you for that, and thank you for all the stuff you're learning and willing to move into as you learn. I think that's so important, you know.
Right.
So we've always heard about Labor Day. That's, you know, I know I grew up with Labor Day, and it's hot dogs and beer and, you know, whatever else. But it seems the need for reform and for fairness in the workplace is becoming more apparent to people. You know, it seems like there's a lot more interest in worker relations and news of strikes, the railroad strike, the screenwriters, actors getting attention. Are you hearing that more? Are you seeing
Well, in my circle, which of course is I'm also living in a housing co-op, so this is maybe a little skewed. But at least in, you know, the circles that I am in, there's definitely a lot of interest. I'm hearing it even from people back home in Texas, where I grew up, that are becoming more involved in labor, which is really great. I love seeing like this young impulse and this young drive to change things. So yeah, I am definitely seeing that from where I am.
Yeah, good. Yeah, and that's partly why when I met you on Labor Day down at Madison's Labor Fest, I was also looking for someone younger with passion about what kinds of things are happening today. Because, you know, when I grew up in a very union worker labor enclave in Western Pennsylvania. The steel mills were flourishing. It was before everything shut down. You know, and that's in my blood, you know, to see that. But it has totally changed that area. Yeah. You know, it's totally changed. So, and the term worker justice, I don't even think, I can't imagine many people using that term. So that's another thing I'd love to hear you unpack a little bit.
Right. Yeah, I come from a very different labor background.
And that's why you're on here.
Yeah. my dad worked for ABF in trucking in Texas and crossed the picket line twice with the Teamsters and was rewarded for it. So he definitely did not come from that kind of background, but it, you know, eventually even my dad came around.
Even your dad.
Even he did.
That's great. We have hope then, right?
we do have hope. He was in management, so that tells you a lot. But yeah, I'm really hopeful that, you know, younger people are, you know, getting more involved with workplace things. Scuffle, for instance, has a young workers committee. You know,
For people listening in, what is Scuffle?
Oh, Scuffle, yeah. It's a South Central Federation of Labor, and it's just pronouncing all those words together, or all those letters, is Scuffle.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the federation that includes about like 90 unions, including firefighters and nurses, in the South Central area of Wisconsin.
And so that's growing, hey?
There's a growing interest for sure.
That's just really good to hear. So if you're just tuning in, my name is Dina Eccles, and the show you're listening to is Conversations. It's an opportunity that we have to learn from and about each other. And today's guest on the show is Frieda Ballard, and she is with the Worker Justice, what is it?
Worker Justice Wisconsin.
Thank you. I didn't think it was organization. And your organization is also a member of the Wisconsin Network for Peace and Justice, which I'm a member of as well. That's how I first heard about your organization.
Oh, great, yeah.
So what do you do for worker justice?
Yeah, so my role is co-op incubation. So I started off doing split time between co-op incubation for worker co-ops, and my other time that I would spend there would be on construction worker organizing. But now we have a full-time position that does that, Daniela Jaime, who will be speaking at COWS tomorrow. So now I get to focus entirely on co-op incubation.
Okay, now let's back up. Incubation, what does that mean?
Yeah, so we select a couple groups of workers a year, educate them on how to operate in a democratic way, how to take meeting minutes, how to hold meetings, how to file their bylaws, doing all these things in relation to the governance of it. And then we have a lot of other partners in a huge network that help us fill in their gaps of knowledge that they need. So it could be computer literacy training, it could be financial literacy training, whatever kind of gaps they have. And with all of them, we also have them do conflict resolution training as well.
Oh, this is all very interesting. So how long has that been happening?
Since I started in May of 2022. So not that long.
Oh, okay. But you've created this network with many different organizations that can help do these trainings or leadership segments, I guess.
Mm-hmm,
that's
right.
This is really good. So how many people have you been able to work with?
So we have two co-ops currently. We've interviewed a lot of people in the selection, but we selected a food truck. They're food cart, but they will be upgrading into a truck that we've been incubating called El Chisme. And then we have Shaky Hands. It's an existing screen printing co-op in Milwaukee, and we're expanding to Madison.
That's great. Shaky Hands is a screen printing shop. Okay.
Uh-huh. Like, yeah.
Well, this is really good, and it's helping people manage to survive, I would get imagine.
Right.
Yeah. Wow. So that's a great thing you get to do.
Yeah, I'm so lucky.
And before you were doing that, you said you were working with the construction?
Yes.
And what was that like?
So that looked like, and while I was doing it, not nearly as involved as it is now that we have a full-time position for it, but it looked like trying to organize workers in the construction industry. It could mean trying to get a group to collectively recover their stolen wages or improve working conditions, some individual cases as well. And then if, when impossible, also refer them and get them signed on to a union.
Mm-hmm. So how are you greeted when you start to do this? I mean, it's not always copacetic. It's not always, everybody's not always so eager to see you arrive on the scene, right?
Oh, right. I introduce myself as an organizer, which probably doesn't mean a lot to many people, but I introduce that, you know, I work for a nonprofit and give them my card, explain if they want to know more about their rights and if they've had any workplace issues to talk to me. So kind of quickly give information, get out before I get in trouble.
Okay.
Yeah,
because, you know, that whole concept of being an organizer doesn't go well in certain parts of the state.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, it's a shame, really, because if people understood our history more, they would appreciate the kind of work that you're doing.
Right, and many workers, unfortunately, especially immigrant workers, are told if you see anyone that's a stranger on site, leave because they could be OSHA. So especially me being a woman who doesn't look like they're probably there to do work, they also really assume that I am there for some kind of compliance, either the government or the city government, DWD, OSHA. So they assume the worst and assume that they're not there to help.
Right. So, yeah, this is so confusing, isn't it?
Right.
You know, just here we are, just human beings trying to get by, and you know, so much abuse and usury that goes on.
Oh, yeah.
I guess it's giving you an opportunity to do some good, but it'd be nice to not have to do it too.
Right. So yeah, part of what my coworker Daniela is doing is, you know, making herself a familiar face, because strangers are, you know, people are wary of strangers on a
mm-hmm,
site,
mm-hmm.
But she makes her presence like very routine and regular to hopefully build some confidence that, you know, she's someone that they can talk to.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually some people do talk. But only if they've seen you for a while and you've talked to them as a person first and then later as a worker.
Yeah, no, that's good. And that's why, you know, even when we started, when we discussed having you on the radio, and I said the first thing I like to do is, you know, establish what your passions are and why. Because as a human being, you know, yes, you're an organizer, you know, but yes, you're a human being. And
right.
That's what's really driving you.
Exactly, to
do what you do. And I think when people see that, even if they have an opposition to organizers, you know, I think that can help.
Right.
In communication. So there's this concept of worker misclassification, and I'm not sure many people fully understand. I've even read it over and over again and don't always understand what's happening there. So could you kind of fill that out a little bit for us?
Yeah, for sure. So I can kind of put into perspective and like the sense of like what a job would look like. So, you know, somebody hires, it could be the government, it could be a, you know, regular citizen. They want to get a job done, right? A house built, for instance. If you don't know a whole lot and don't know the context for different trades, you probably just go to a general contractor who will just take care of everything else. So that could be, in this, you know, instance, one that I see a lot around here is Stevens. They're a non-union general contractor. And so you might hire Stevens as a general contractor, and then they'll take care of everything else. And so then what that means is that general contractor Stevens might go and hire 10 different companies of 10 different specialties. So the masons and the roofers and the insulation and, you know, all those different trades, right?
Mm.
So they'll hire companies. So those are all different companies and not individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And then that, say, the insulation company realizes, wow, we need 20 guys. I don't want to hire 20 guys of, you know, for my own workforce. And so then they might go and find a group of regular people on the street. They might see them working on a different building and ask them if they are looking for more work.
Mm.
And so they often pose it as, hey, if you're looking for work, call me. If you can set up an LLC, then I can hire you and all your men.
Mm.
And so it's often just a guy that's laboring somewhere else. They find them in the supermarket. They find them very informally.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the times they're assumed to be undocumented, which sometimes is true, sometimes isn't. They target, you know, Latino immigrant workers that might not know better, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're just like looking for the next gig.
Yeah.
And so that person who's then approached by this company, they're told that if they take out an LLC, then they can be hired legally. And that's a really, that's the thing that, you know, is the hook that gets them in. Because, of course, if you're undocumented, you can't be an employee, but you can be a business owner, which is very strange.
Yeah.
So, you know, they take out an LLC, but then unknowingly, they're not told of all the responsibilities that come with that.
Right.
And so then if something happens on the work site, the money runs dry, they go over budget, the guy at the very bottom with that LLC and then all of his men are the ones that suffer all the brunts of it.
Got it.
So essentially, the responsibility for the payroll taxes and the income tax and the insurance, the workers' comp insurance and the liability insurance, all of it has to fall on this guy who doesn't actually have any resources to make that happen.
Right. So it's it's sidestepping. It's a way to keep doing what has always been being done. We're just using people.
Exactly.
And not providing properly for them. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, that's you did a good job explaining that, and I appreciate it.
Yeah, for sure. It's definitely really complicated. So, you know,
yeah,
explaining what an employee is and what a contractor is. The way we try to explain it to workers is often just think of who's calling the shots, and if that's not you, you're not a contractor. And that's really what it ends up being is people that are mistaken in their definition of what a contractor is. Mm-hmm. But then by this time they find out they're owing a lot of money in taxes, and it's too late.
Yeah, wow. Well, you guys are doing really important work then.
Thank you.
Justice Wisconsin. How many, do you know roughly how many people might be affected in this way? Is there any kind of estimate? Has anybody done any studies?
Yeah, there is. I don't remember I can pull the citation later, but there is an estimate from last year mm-hmm. in Wisconsin that about 10% of all construction workers are misclassified.
Wow.
Which, of course, is an underestimate because mm-hmm. there's so many people that are just unwilling to talk. Like what I said, they don't think that a person that steps onto a work site is there to help you. So we know that it's a much higher number, actually, and that it's mostly immigrant workers. So that's about 14,500 workers, roughly.
Huh. That's a chunk of people. And it's not just the workers, you know, it's their families. It's
right,
everybody
right.
that's involved in that. Yeah, it's very, well. So what other kinds of worker justice focuses would you say that the organization covers?
Yeah, so aside from cooperatives and construction, we're also, you know, making some progress in some service industries. I can't speak too much. It's a little top secret still.
Oh, okay. Well, we won't tell anybody what you just said.
So yeah, some service industry, we're still kind of feeling out what are some good targets,
mm-hmm.
And also potentially some manufacturing. So mm-hmm. these are all industries that right. we see the most of.
And there's a lot, I know I've been following a lot about, of course, increasing wages to a living wage and mm-hmm. the movement towards ending tipping.
Yes.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so...
It's not top secret, right?
Yeah, no. it would be, you know, of course, we're limited in Wisconsin by preemption, which is really unfortunate. But there's some... should I define preemption?
Yes, please. I was going to ask you. But...
Yeah, so there's legislation in Wisconsin, I think passed in 2015, something like that, that limits... any municipality or any county that wanted to pass legislation that handled anything about wages, so increasing the minimum wage or changing the enforcement about wages, all of that now has to go to the state, and the counties and cities cannot pass any new legislation about it and cannot enforce any new legislation. So essentially, yeah, Milwaukee and Madison, which are places that have a higher cost of living, cannot increase their minimum wage without going through the state. And so that's a real bummer for us.
Mm-hmm,
But we have some things in the works. We have an executive committee, so it's a group of workers that are very invested and have some of them have previous union experience in their home countries.
Mm-hmm.
And are kind of have that mindset already.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're thinking of ways to push policy to improve the conditions for all workers.
Right. Good. I'm kind of chuckling because, again, where I'm from was steel country. And before that, it was coal country in western Pennsylvania. And they brought in workers, you know, Carnegie and Mellon, if you're familiar uh-huh. with the... they brought in workers from Europe thinking that they wouldn't be able to unionize because they probably wouldn't be able to speak to one another.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting history, actually.
Yeah.
It really
yeah.
is. It's fascinating. And because the Italians, and that's my background, so half of it, were socialists. They were unionizing. They were doing these things in Italy. So when they came over, they were like, wait a second. We need to come together. And they found mm-hmm. ways to do it. And, you know, it was pretty, That's why sometimes when I see how the union movement in Western Pennsylvania has diminished, it just blows my mind, because, you know, the homestead riots where the Pinkertons came and shot and killed people who were striking, you know. I mean, there's such a history there that people need to be reminded of, I think.
Right, right.
Because this should be not happening. You know, fair pay for fair work. That's just the way it should be. And but it, you know, there's so many things in the way we approach money in this country, and many places in the world. It's not just here, but we've allowed money to come before human beings, and I think that's been a tremendous mistake.
Right.
So hopefully, people's voices will continue to, you know, as they did. I mean, that was when they fought for the 8-hour day and the, you know, children's. And I mean, it's interesting. We're having to have these discussions again because they're wanting to lower the age for children to work again. You know, blaming the workforce.
Right.
You know, it's not enough workforce. I mean, it's absurd. And again, that's why I wanted to have you on today. I wanted someone from your organization, and I was so happy to meet you at the Labor Fest, because we need these voices to be heard. You know, we need, because what you get in the regular media, this isn't what you hear.
Mm-hmm.
More and more, especially with the striking, I think they're even showing that people are caring more. They're leaning more again towards unions instead of away from it.
Right.
But, yeah. It's interesting.
Yeah, and we have a lot of hope for our community here and our committee that we're developing, because yes, it's you know, one thing. I am also very conscious of, you know, where I come from and my position, and I never want to make part of our purpose with the committee is, you know, more people knocking on doors and, you know, getting the word out about workers' rights, but also that it's coming from their neighbors, that their own neighbors are telling them how they can get involved and how they can uplift their own their own communities. Because I'm not necessarily their neighbors, and I also recognize that, you know, I'm a Chicana, and I am not an immigrant. My parent was an immigrant, but I'm not, and you know, I want to be cognizant of that.
Mm-hmm.
And but thankfully there are more protections in working together. There is a new deferred action that started this year. Should I elaborate on that?
Sure, please.
So it's this new memorandum between the Department of Labor and the Department of Homeland Security. So if any worker experiences any kind of violation of their rights and they go to an agency and are fearful of retaliation based on their immigration status, they can request that agency to write them a letter to the Department of Homeland Security asking for a work permit for 2 years. So essentially it means if you stand up for yourself, if you ask for protections, then you can actually get rewarded in having a 2-year work permit. And if there's no potential, and you can keep renewing this potentially indefinitely. So it definitely opens the door. It levels the playing field from immigrants to citizens, that they can be certain that nothing will happen to them and they will stay here.
Well, if you're just tuning in, my name is Dina Eccles, and you're listening to Conversations on WDRT. And my guest today on Conversations is Frieda Ballard, and she is with the Worker Justice Wisconsin organization. And we've been talking about all kinds of things work-related, fairness, justice, programs available through Worker Justice Wisconsin, and some firsthand experience that she's had. So I'm really enjoying this. I knew I'd get a lot out of it, and that was, I always kind of choose that way. It's like, what do I want to learn about, you know? And I think it's important. I think these voices are super important.
Thank you.
So one of the other things that you did mention when I when we chatted was the role that faith plays in your organization. You know, the outreach towards faith faith-based organizations.
Yeah. So first, worker justice has been around for as long as I've been alive, actually. And it started as an interfaith coalition,
uh-huh.
And then the interfaith coalition and then the worker center eventually split into two different organizations, and then merged once again. Faith and labor are, you know, very connected. And when I was first hired, I was not very sure about what that meant. But now that I've seen, you know, firsthand with workers that we've assisted, it is very clear now what that connection is.
Mm-hmm.
From what I've seen, you can tell workers all day long about the legislation that is out there that will protect them against retaliation if they file a wage complaint, a discrimination complaint, or if they're organizing. And you can school them all you want on, like, the law, but if they don't feel that their faith also supports that, they won't do it.
Right. Interesting.
They want to be certain of, you know, that they're legally protected, but also that they're not committing some affront to God.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to really support them on both ends if we want it to be sustainable. Mm-hmm. The executive director of Worker Justice, Rebecca Meyer Rao,
mm-hmm.
she's a theologian. And that's her background. She taught at Edgewood College for, I think, 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And she has taught us about liberation theology and Catholic social teaching. And so that is something that we can draw from if we see hesitations from workers
mm-hmm.
Regarding their faith.
I think that's great. That's really great.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm aware of the interfaith working groups in Wisconsin as well, and I think they do amazing work trying to educate people on many levels, you know. So, yeah, it's great to hear that they're working together.
Right. And we are currently looking for a faith organizer. Our last one, unfortunately, parted ways with us and is now doing also some pretty radical stuff with... it's a Catholic, like a Catholic,
Catholic workers.
So yeah, but we are looking for somebody that can speak on, you know, many faiths,
right.
Not just Catholicism.
Right. Excellent. Well, I think that will be very useful on many levels, you know, because this, I mean, again, citing my history, raised Catholic in
mm-hmm.
a very, you know, devout way. But my understanding of Christianity and how I was raised is very different than the Christianity that I see playing out around me, positions people take, anti-gay, anti-many things. So I think to remember again some of the, because, you know, you mentioned the word radical. Jesus was a radical.
Right, right.
So that's my position anyway. So I don't,
right, exactly.
I don't see you as being radical, my dear.
I know. But yeah, it's interesting because, yeah, Catholicism is a very, you know, I can speak to that a little. I, you know, also grew up Catholic in Mexico and in Texas. And yeah, Catholicism is very centered on community. And if you
mm-hmm.
if you care about your community, then you care about workers' rights inherently.
Mm-hmm.
Because any affront to the worker is an affront to the family and the community. It ripples through everybody. So it is a no-brainer once you connect those dots, but it's hard to see it when sometimes what is preached is, you know, what not to do instead of what to do.
Right.
But yeah, the connection is there, and it is supported, and we want to, you know, let people know that they can do it, and that their faith very much wants them to mm-hmm. stand up for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, fear. This, unfortunately, there's been so much fear introduced into our culture.
Right.
Fear of other. You know?
Yes.
And it's, you know, it seems to cycle through. First it was, you know, let's fear the Irish, let's fear the Italians, let's fear, now we're fearing the people from the South, you know, and it's really time for that to end. And I agree with you. I think that younger people are taking a good look at that, and they're looking at what they're inheriting, and they're
right.
saying, wow, wait a second, you know, I didn't have anything to do with creating this mess, and I'd like to find a way out of it as quickly as possible.
Exactly, yeah.
So let's make sure everybody knows how to find Worker Justice Wisconsin. The website, I'm assuming, is what?
WorkerJustice.org.
That's simple, WorkerJustice.org. You don't even have to think about Wisconsin like I did earlier.
And, yeah.
And is there a phone number or...
Yeah, you can reach any of us. We all have individual lines.
Okay.
So my number, if you're interested in cooperatives, is 608-347-1423.
Mm-hmm.
And then Rebecca Meyer Rao, who is our executive director, hers is 608-215-4336, and you know, she can speak to the faith aspect a lot much better than the rest of us, you know, possibly could. And Robert Crystal is our program director, so he focuses mm-hmm. on service and manufacturing industries, and you can reach him at 608-866-0651. And then Daniela, who's a construction organizer, she's at 608-509-8582. So the best way to reach us is through our direct line, because we're often on the go. And these are our cell phone numbers. People can text us, leave us voice memos, find us on WhatsApp. And so we try to make it as accessible for folks as possible.
Yeah, that's great. And if you wanted to say anything to people who might be listening in, who are Spanish speaking, welcome.
Yeah, Sí, para toda la comunidad latina que nos escucha, nomás le quería compartir de que el miedo no les protege y solamente el pueblo salva al pueblo.
All right. Yeah, let's bring it together here. So anything else that you'd like to share with everyone? Any other understandings or?
I suppose the through line with everything, the cooperatives, the organizing, everything is that, you know, individual cases will not create new laws. It will not save us from the situation that we're in. And so the only way to actually protect yourself and your community is to stick your head out. That's the only tried and true method. So I encourage everybody, you know, we encounter this with, of course, immigrant workers that are afraid. But everybody's afraid.
Mm.
Citizens are also
mm-hmm.
afraid.
Mm-hmm.
And it's totally normal. It's totally normal to be afraid. Your boss wants you to be afraid. But yeah, conquering fear is a very important aspect of growth.
Mm. Yeah, and I think the fear is by design.
Oh, exactly.
You know?
Totally.
And so that's why I like having these conversations. This is like... What do you mean? Wait, what does all this mean? And if anybody's been listening throughout this program, I'm hoping that they've gained a lot of understanding about what can be happening. And this is just one more possibility. I mean, there's so many ways that we can bring each other back to a humane and human way of approaching one another, you know? You guys are organizing. You guys are helping people learn what their rights are.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so, it's critical. I think there's so many ways that we all can be helping one another out of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I also want to mention really quickly,
one
thing that I've also, you know, learned through this work is that employers often don't know what employment law is or with labor law is. So a lot of the times, by the time we talk to workers and inform them of their rights, they actually know more than their boss does, and they have a much better toolbox than their employer does. Having a business is not does not say anything about their knowledge, is what I found, because it is so easy to open a business. It's like getting a driver's license without knowing how to drive. You're not taught on what you actually need to know. And so, this is not to attack business owners, but just to empower workers that, you know, the more you know, the better you can protect yourself.
Right. And it's not about attacking anyone. And I think that's fascinating. And it's probably really, really true. You know, people are doing what they've seen done around them. You know, and I'm talking about employers that way. You know, well, this is the way to do it. And yeah.
Exactly. It's a repetition of the cycle of abuse, right? Mm-hmm. People know what they've seen, and they won't change until they learn otherwise. Mm.
Yeah, and let's just touch on one more thing. There's this idea that spins around in this new age that I don't know. But it's about people are poor because they're lazy. You know, people are, they don't have what they need because even though they're working three jobs and, you know, they're getting paid peanuts, somehow we do believe poverty is a reflection of their character, not something inherent in the system. And I think that can't be said too many times, that people need to check that and they need to look at that. You know, you need let's take a good hard look at why. You know, I know there was a lot of shame. I grew up with a lot of shame around poverty and not whatever, you know. And it takes a long time. You have to really work at that one. But again, you come back, you honor yourself as a human being, you know, and walk your way through that, because that's what you're doing. You're empowering people, and I love that word of empowering.
Right, and the shame that that comes with the poverty is so much more vicious when it's also paired it's used in their face to like weaponize their own poverty against themselves. I've heard from workers say, if God wanted me to be rich, wouldn't I not be living in poverty still? And accepting that as like their fate, accepting that as their destiny, and that's what God wants for them.
And
even the idea that being, you know, poor, and in Spanish often they say humilde, which is humble but also poor in the same word, that it's closer to the experience of Jesus. And that makes you holier. And sort of the idea that having ownership or having stake in a business is inherently bad. I think we know that passage of it's easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter heaven.
People say that all the time. I don't think that had anything to do with his money. I think that had to do with attitude.
It did. And so there's this twisting of scripture. There's a misunderstanding of the power dynamics and of the systems that actually keep them in the position that they're in, like in what I was talking about, the levels and levels of subcontracting and misclassification that occur. At each level, there's up to 20% of that money that passes from one person to the next is just profit, and they have done no work. Right. It's just it's capital. It's just dead labor. It doesn't actually reflect any work done. So by the time it actually gets to the worker, it's a tenth of what it was. It's a tenth of what it should be. And it's not the worker's fault. And a lot of what we have to do is unlearn this personal guilt and this personal responsibility for their poverty.
Right, right. Unlearning.
Which is always tied to their faith.
Yeah. And boy, has that been laid on us, you know, that there's been so much of that laid on us. We all have to come out of it Everybody has to come out of it. The people who feel empowered just because you're a white man, you automatically have certain privileges. Mm-hmm. And you need to unlearn that. You need to unlearn that sense. I'm big on that.
Right.
And that's why I keep always coming back to be a human being.
Right.
Be a human being first. Whatever you do in your life, be a human being first. Be a human being before you're an organizer,
Mm-hmm.
Before you're a radio speaker, before I'm doing this show, I have to be a human being first. I have to want to learn from you,
Mm-hmm.
It does make it work. For me, it does anyway.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Workers often feel even more ashamed, almost,
right,
to speak up than they are to just suffer in silence,
mm,
which is a real shame. It's not their burden to carry.
Right, no.
But they feel that it is, mm, and it's something that we have to battle every day.
Mm. Well, keep up that battle. So in this last minute, I really want to thank you.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. It was great to meet you on Monday at the Labor Fest. It's great to know that you're there working in the Worker Justice Program. And I really hope people take this radio show and share it. And you get a lot more calls from it. Anything else you'd like to say?
I don't think so. I think we covered everything.
Well, one day let's have a chat about your cooperative, your living cooperative. I'd like to...
Mm-hmm.
I think more people need to learn about that as well.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay, Frida, well, you have a great day.
And
thank you. Everybody who's listening, thank you for listening. And let's bring some change to this world, eh?
Hey, thank you for having me.
Mm, pleasure.